Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Sharkies to Sharkpedia. This is Megan and Imani, and we are so excited to have Dr. Andrew Nozell on the show today. Dr. Nozell, can you please introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm broadcasting from San Diego, which is the traditional and unceded territory of the Kumeyaay people. So I am an adjunct assistant professor at the University of San Diego. And so my job there is mostly teaching focused, but I still have a visiting assistant researcher position at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which is where I got my PhD from. And so I still get to do research with undergrads and master's students, but it's mostly in the summer. And I would say broadly, I would consider myself a movement ecologist. So I'm really interested in the causes and consequences of animal movement. And for the last 10 or so years, I've been focusing that on sharks and rays in California and Baja California.
Super cool. We are so excited to have you on. Thank you so much. Megan, would you like to go ahead and introduce the article that we're going to be talking about today and give a little bit of a summary?
So today we're reviewing the article, Triennial Migration and Philopatry in the Critically Endangered Soupfin Shark, Galeorhynchus galeus, which is one of the coolest sharks that I've also had an opportunity of seeing in person. So I'm so excited to review this article. And the summary that I have for you all today is that this article talked about the annual migrations, and they are fairly common because seasonal changes happen and help animals anticipate and prepare for migrations. This makes yearly migrations fairly common, whereas multi-annual cycles, which happen more than every year, are very rare. However, it's more common in cartilaginous fishes like sharks and rays to migrate on a biennial basis, which is every other year, because these fishes typically reproduce once every 2 years. However, soupfin sharks reproduce once every 3 years. In this study, the authors predicted that their triennial migrations and the reproduction would coincide together. So they would reproduce once every 3 years and migrate once every 3 years. To test this, they surgically implanted passive acoustic tags into 34 pregnant female sharks over the course of 7 years off the coast of La Jolla, which is in San Diego County in California. By tagging these animals, they were able to determine that soupfin sharks in this area were philopatric, meaning that they would return to the same site. They had a triennially reproductive period that coincided with their reproduction, and that La Jolla served as a gestating ground for female soupfin sharks. So I might go a little bit out of order with our first question, just because that last sentence, I forgot that I talked about what a gestating ground is. So could you just briefly talk, what is a gestating ground? What does that mean in terms of reproduction for sharks?
So in terms of reproduction, we often think of, you know, pupping grounds and nursery areas, but there can be other, I want to say these important areas can serve other functions. And so in the case of the soupfin sharks, and we've also seen this with leopard sharks in this area, we've concluded this is a gestating ground. So they're not giving birth here, at least not that we can tell, but it is mostly the mature pregnant females that are hanging out. And we know that they're pregnant because over the years, we've done ultrasounds on them. We have dissected a few that have washed ashore dead. And in every case where we have the chance to determine pregnancy, they have in fact been pregnant.
Oh, that's super cool. And can we just briefly talk about, you know, you mentioned in the paper that soupfin sharks, and it's in the title, that they're critically endangered. Where do you find this shark, and what's unique about this shark, and what makes them critically endangered?
Right, so they're critically endangered on the global level. So they're in fact globally distributed. So they are a temperate coastal pelagic species, We have them, of course, in the eastern North Pacific, off the US, off the west coast of North America. They're also found in South America, in the Northeast Atlantic, Southern Africa, and Australia and New Zealand. So there's basically these five genetically distinct populations, and they go by different names, right? We call them soup fin sharks, but in Australia and New Zealand, they're called school sharks. And in Europe, they're called taupe. So they have a bunch of different names. Now, why they're critically endangered, they have been subject to decades of heavy fishing pressure. There's been a lot of demand for their meat, for one. It's fairly high quality. Their fins, that's one of the reasons why we call them soup fin sharks. And also, historically at least, for their very large livers, which are rich in vitamin A. So off California, for instance, in the run-up to and during World War II, there was a lot of demand for vitamin A. And the best source of that at the time was soup fin shark. So soup fins were the mainstay of the shark fishery. It was kind of this bonanza type atmosphere. And so their population was quickly depleted. And then sometime, I want to say in the 1940s, synthetic vitamin A was discovered. And so now there was no longer such a high demand for natural sources of vitamin A. And so the fishery collapsed at that time. So again, globally, there's still quite a bit of fishing pressure for them, which is why they've reached the status of critically endangered. This was just a recent thing. They just were uplisted last year. It's unclear, though, what's happening off California. Just anecdotally, I have a feeling that the population is doing better than the global average. But as I'm sure we'll talk about later, there's never been a stock assessment. And so we don't know for sure what's happening with the population.
Right, right. So you said that their meat is high quality. I'm just curious what makes it high quality. Is it the high vitamin A content? Because I feel like normally when you talk about shark meat, it's considered to be not as nutritious as other forms of meat. And so I'm just curious what makes it high quality.
It's a good question. So I don't think it's the vitamin A per se. I think that's mostly concentrated in the liver. But I mean, what makes it, well, the most important thing about shark meat nutritionally is the protein content. And in many parts of the world where they're fished, that may be the only somewhat affordable source of protein. But what I mean by high quality is more about the texture and the taste of it. And as long as the shark is prepared the proper way, that is when it's caught, the fisher bleeds it quite quickly so that urea doesn't collect in the tissue, giving it kind of a foul taste, it's actually very good eating. So that's what I mean. So basically it's a marketable meat.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, that's really common. And I study seven gill sharks, which is my background photo here. And that's also common. They're really common eating in the Bay Area as well. I've heard they're really nutritious and really good eating. Mm-hmm. Do you know, I should know this, but is vitamin A really common in most shark species liver?
At least in the liver, yes. And I think what makes soup fins especially attractive in that purpose, they have like a larger proportional, a larger than you would expect size liver, given their body size.
Sure. Yeah. And for people that don't know, shark livers are just absolutely enormous. This is why they've been targeted in previous years in general, is because there's so much liver oil available. And their liver takes almost the entire stomach cavity in their body. So truly, like, the length of their stomach cavity is filled with liver, and then all their other organs are compressed underneath that. So livers are absolutely huge. And let's talk quickly about what is triennial reproductive migration and reproduction. We talk about it a lot. It's in the title of this, and we briefly talked about in the summary. There's biennial migration and reproduction is common in other sharks, but what's triennial reproduction? How do we even know that that's frequent in soup fin sharks? How did you determine that? And what's so cool about it? Because I find it amazing.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why soup fin sharks are so interesting, because they are one of the few shark and ray species with a triennial reproductive cycle. So all that means is that the mature females are, on average, giving birth only once every 3 years. right? So some species are annual, for example, leopard sharks, they give birth every year. Those are California leopard sharks. There are also biennially reproducing sharks, like lemon sharks. Those females give birth on average every 2 years. And then you've got a few, like soupfin sharks, tiger sharks, and a handful of others that give birth once every 3 years. Now, what we noticed was that shark species whose females give birth every year, they tend to exhibit annual philopatry, meaning that they're tagged at a location, they leave, but they come back the next year and the year after that and so on and so on. They're returning to the same place every year. Meanwhile, in sharks that are biennial reproducers, the females that are tagged exhibit biennial patterns of philopatry. So they're tagged, they're gone for 2 years, and then they're back, right? So no one had really tagged and tracked soupfin sharks for a long enough period of time to determine whether the pattern would hold. That is, they're triennial reproducers. Will the females exhibit a triennial cycle of migration and philopatry? So that was the hypothesis that we had and the one that we set out to test.
Yeah, and it looks like in the methods you talk about, you actually tagged sharks over a 7 year period. So I imagine you had to do that every year to catch enough animals that would come back after 3 years. Is that right?
Yeah, so we actually tagged our 34 sharks in five distinct cohorts, so five distinct years. And, you know, when we first started this, you know, we tagged sharks in the first year and, you know, we figured, all right, we're going to have to go at least another 2 years. And then once we saw in the fourth year, sharks returning that we tagged in the first year that we hadn't seen in the middle 2 years, we're like, all right, well, we can't just stop at 4 years because someone's going to say, well, how do you know this wasn't just a one-off event, right? So we kept going and we kept going and going and going. And we were able to show that in multiple independently tagged cohorts, they were showing this triennial reproductive cycle. And in fact, one shark that we tagged in 2014 came back 3 years later and then 6 years after tagging. So we actually captured two full triennial cycles for at least one shark.
That's so cool. Megan and I are like fangirling about this paper, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, we really are. I saw that in the paper too, that you got one individual that came back twice. And just being out in the field enough, I know how hard it is to get that kind of data point. So just to show that reoccurrence is amazing.
And I know we're going to talk about like field stories later, yeah. And I have something else to tell about that, but that moment in, I'm just trying to think of what year it would have been. It would have been, we tagged it in 2014, came back in 2017, and then in 2020, we knew we were looking out for sharks that we tagged in 2014. And so, you know, when we download the data, you know, I'm like scrolling through and I'm looking for the code. I know the code by heart. And that moment when I saw it, I was like, and when that moment when it's just you and your data and you're the only one in the world that knows the answer to a question, it's like a really special moment. And so that's something I'll never forget. It was just so cool to have one individual come back with two full cycles.
Absolutely. I mean, for the people who are not shark researchers and don't go out and do field work, it is incredibly hard to re-catch the same species multiple times, especially if you're not sure if they stay in the same area. Like nurse sharks, for example, sometimes people have really high re-catch rates because they do not migrate that much, they don't travel that far, and you can re-catch them in the same place. But for a shark that migrates like a soupfin, it is insane that you caught it two separate times again.
Yeah, I have one seven-gill that I've caught twice in San Francisco Bay, and also that getting that recapture was just also incredible because we just have conventional tags, just an external ID marker on them for now, and so getting that reoccurring data is extremely difficult because you just have to be out there fishing and hope you catch the animal again, so not the same.
Yes, and luckily here though, these sharks were tagged with acoustic transmitter, so I didn't actually have to catch them, because you're right, that would have been crazy coincidence. But the fact that we had acoustic receivers monitoring the aggregation site where we tagged them, that made it a lot easier for us to, you know, to hear back from the animal when it returned.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is a really good point to actually talk and ask, what are the tags that you used? And let's just briefly talk about the different types of tags you can have, because there's so many different types. We've already talked about two different types of tags in the last couple of minutes.
Right. So of course, conventional tags would be something like a spaghetti tag, right? Nothing fancy, no electronics, just some contact info and an ID number. So that's if somebody catches your shark, they can report back to you, and maybe you put like a little dollar sign on it because you want to give them some sort of compensation for reporting the animal back. What we use were coded acoustic pinger tags. So these are about the size of your index finger, about, you know, kind of a somewhat longer than a AA battery. And because we knew we wanted to tag and track these animals for many years, we had to surgically implant these into the sharks. So we caught the sharks one by one, and we brought them over to the side of the boat. We kept them in the water the whole time. We rotate them on their backs, which induces tonic immobility, which is kind of this state of hypnosis. What's happening physiologically is not totally understood, but it's a really useful tool if we need to handle a shark and, you know, keep the shark safe and keep us safe. So basically, we surgically implant the tag right into the stolomic cavity. And then we stitch up the wound, and then we release the shark. Now, once the shark is at liberty, it can go wherever it wants. But every time it swims within about 1,000 feet, 300 meters or so, of one of our underwater acoustic receivers, that acoustic receiver records the time, the date, and the code for that particular shark. And so these receivers are about a foot long, a couple of inches in diameter, and they are attached to underwater moorings. And we know the GPS positions of these. So in the La Jolla area, we had about 50 or so of these acoustic receivers wrapping around this promontory, this part of the coastline that sticks out. But then we had to team up with folks and other parts of Southern California, the Central Coast, even all the way up into Oregon and Washington, to basically help monitor. Because everybody has these same kinds of receivers out, but they're all monitoring their own fish. But because we all use the same technology, we can all hear each other's animals and we can share data. So it's really important to collaborate. And that's one of the reasons why we have 15 authors on this paper, because it would not have been possible without all of these people contributing. So the benefits of acoustic pinger tags like this: fairly long battery life. So the first year we tagged them, the best we could do was like 3 to 4 years, about 4 years actually. Once we started tagging sharks in 2014, the technology got better. So now our max battery life was about 7 years. And now you can get tags that last 10 years. So really long battery life. But of course, the downside is that you can only monitor sharks where you have acoustic receivers, right? So there's obviously big gaps, but you can piece it together. And if you know, very careful about the research question you're asking, that ends up not being a problem.
Yeah, and there's other types of tags, like we mentioned before, that are much more either expensive or they just serve different purposes depending on your question, right? So right now I just have conventional tags. I hope to use passive acoustic tags like you're using. There's also things like satellite tags where that receiver is constantly talking to a satellite. That requires for your animal to be near the surface of the water so that that satellite tag can actually communicate to a satellite. The seven gill shark, which I study, is often in very deep water, around 100 meters, so that doesn't work. Soup fins, somewhat similar, they can also go in pretty deep water, so those don't really work.
And it doesn't even have to be deep, as long as they're just a few inches, but well, as long as they're just underwater, they could be an inch below the water and that radio signal is not going to transmit. And that's the case for soup fins. They rarely fin at the surface. They're always under the water.
Right. Yeah, so those passive acoustic tags are pretty useful if you know where to put your buoys or your receivers.
Exactly. And yes, that's right. Were spaghetti tags and acoustic tags put on an animal at the same time? Like they had a spaghetti tag and they also had an acoustic tag?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm curious.
And the reason we do...
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm curious what the advantage to that is. My guess was going to be if a fisherman, for example, caught one, they can ID the shark for you and give you a call. And I'm wondering, like, for our listeners, if you could explain how a tag like that with just an ID number on it works.
Right. So if we only surgically implanted the acoustic pinger tag, we could only get acoustic detection data. If a fisher caught that shark, you know, assuming it was, I don't know, a couple of weeks after we tagged it, if we did our job right, maybe a pencil thin scar at most, there would be almost no evidence that, you know, that the shark had a tag in it. Sometimes the fisher, you know, when they're cutting open the shark and, you know, starting to fillet it, they may come across the tag, but there's no contact info on the tag. So they'd have to know to like contact the manufacturer and give them the ID code, and then they can trace it back. That's really a big hassle. So we put the spaghetti tags externally as well to facilitate the reporting process. And that worked really well for us because we got a recapture all the way up in Washington State. A shark was caught in a Washington Department of Fish and Game gillnet survey, and it was reported to us, and the shark was released, which was really cool. But then we also had a handful of sharks go south into Mexico, where there is a lot of gillnet activity by artisanal fishers there. And so we also had recaptures in Mexico, and those got reported back to us. But there were very, very few acoustic receivers in Mexico. So basically our only way of knowing that they went this far south were these recaptures, again, that were facilitated by the external tag. So the external tag has a phone number, it has a website to report, and then it has an ID number for that particular shark.
How do typically international fishers report then? Is it usually on your website? Because I imagine they can't probably call the number that's on there.
Right. So so we have a number, and then we've got, right. So there is a website that people can go to. And our sharks only would go to Mexico. We've even gotten a couple of phone calls from Mexican fishers from Baja. So I think nowadays so many people have cell phones, and cell phone plans are so internationalized.
Sure.
We were even contacted via WhatsApp. It's a lot easier to connect these days.
Technology is so nice.
Yeah.
It makes these collaborations so much easier. And that's amazing that you saw the movements from Washington to Mexico. And one of the other questions I had was, you mentioned in the paper that you see aggregations in La Jolla for soup fin sharks. Do you see aggregations of soup fins in other places other than La Jolla of soup fins?
Yeah, so not me personally, but I've certainly heard of other places. Now, we have to be clear about, like, demographically who we're talking about. So what we see in La Jolla, these are mature pregnant females aggregating. I know for sure when I've been out on San Clemente Island, which is one of the southern channel islands, way off about 100 miles off San Diego, or maybe 100 kilometers off San Diego. I have seen lots of large soup fin sharks there. Haven't caught them, haven't determined pregnancy, but I suspect that's another place where pregnant females aggregate. We know historically Catalina Island, which is another of the southern channel islands, lot of soup fins there as well. And periodically you even hear about, you know, small aggregations occurring along the coastline, maybe like off of Long Beach, for instance, but it doesn't stay there for a long period of time. That's what's so special about La Jolla. I mean, once they're there, they're pretty much there every day. Sometimes you have to look for them a little bit because they move around, but they're in the neighborhood.
Is it now, year round they're there? Or is it
no summer? They're really only there in the summer. Yeah, summer and like into early fall, that's when they're most abundant. Now if you go farther north, let's say the northern channel islands off Santa Barbara or into San Francisco Bay, lots of soup fins in there as well. You do get some mature females, but now you also get mature males, and you get subadults and juveniles. So yes, you get aggregations of soup fins in other places, and that's one of the reasons why they're called school sharks in Australia and New Zealand.
Sure.
But the reason that they're aggregating may be different. It may not be for gestating like they are in La Jolla.
Oh, that's so cool. And one of the other things mentioned in the paper is that I think it said that they might go to places like La Jolla because it's warmer and that helps them develop their pups. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I mean, it's been a long time hypothesis that pregnant female sharks are and rays, because they're ectothermic, they are attracted to warm water. And so what is believed is that they are incubating, they're developing embryos, right? So we know that when our body temperature heats up, metabolism increases, all kinds of physiological processes increases, digestion, cell division, that's the one that's important for the growth of the embryos. So the gestation period of these sharks is already about 12 months. So you can imagine that by occupying warmer than average water, that might be able to shorten the gestation a little bit, which could be beneficial. You can see why that behavior could be selected for over time. So that seems to be the case for many different sharks and rays. And with soup fins, which is very interesting, they exhibit latitudinal sexual segregation. So from Northern California up into the Pacific Northwest, almost exclusively adult males. From Southern California, let's say like LA area south, mostly mature females. And then you have from like the Northern Channel Islands up along the central coast of San Francisco, it's about 50-50 males and females. However, the males are found in deeper water than the females. So both the latitudinal segregation and the depth segregation seem to suggest that there's a different temperature preference. It doesn't explain why the males don't come to warm water, right? It explains why the females like the warm water, but not necessarily why the males don't like it or why they like cold water. So that's another interesting part that needs to be figured out.
Oh, that's so cool. Is that common for shark species to be segregated latitudinally? I don't know that I've heard that with other species.
Yeah, I haven't either.
It's been seen in a few other species. I mean, sexual segregation is very common among all the species, right? That's very common,
right.
But you would only see it like latitudinally if it's a very widely distributed species. So in the case of soup fins, at least along this whole west coast of North America, there's enough temperature variation that you could see why that would happen.
That's so cool. So you were talking about gestation periods and gestating grounds. The paper also mentions mating grounds and nursery grounds. So can you just make a distinction between those three? You kind of already defined what a gestating ground is, but for those who don't know, can you define what a mating ground is and what a nursery ground is?
So a mating ground is just where the mating is taking place, right? So a lot of times it's very hard to observe mating directly. So you have to infer that mating happens if there's males and females mixing around in the same location at the same time. That seems to be the case for much of the central coast of California. So it's suspected that this is probably where they are mating. There's also a pupping ground. That's where they're giving birth. Again, it's hard to actually observe the birth and process, right? So you kind of have to infer it. Where are we catching baby soup fin sharks? That also seems to be happening along the central coast. Now, a nursery area, that's a slightly more complicated explanation. It depends on how it's defined. Usually it has to do with where the animals are being born, but then they have to stay there a long period of time. They're getting benefits like maybe protection and food. And there's some segregation from like older age classes as well. So there's a more complicated definition for nursery areas, but that's basically where the juveniles are growing up.
Yeah, I mean, I think a good like species distinction for a nursery ground would be lemon sharks, for example, and how the pups will use mangroves. And there are papers that have come out about things like it protects the pups from larger sharks who may want to eat them. It protects them from predation. It gives them available food that will fit into their mouth and is not limiting to them to eat, and things like that. So nursery grounds are super cool. And I didn't even know what a gestating ground was until I read this paper. So I was super excited to learn that.
Yeah. I thought the other really cool thing that you talked about in this paper is that depending on multiple factors, they seem to have triennial reproduction, but it could vary between 2 and 4 years. So let's talk about that a little bit. So we talk about how they hang out in La Jolla because it's warmer, but what are some other factors that could be affecting that gestation period?
Right. So a little more than half of the sharks that went north after we tagged them and then returned 3 years after tagging, right? Of the remaining sharks, a handful of them left La Jolla and never came back. Maybe they found another aggregation place, maybe San Clemente Island, for instance. Maybe they were caught and just not reported back to us. Maybe they died just naturally, right? So right. Then there's a few more sharks that left and did come back, but not 3 years later. Some of them came back 2 years later or 4 years later. So that's what you're referring to here. And the explanation, we can only guess, right? But for the most part, that variation only happened with the sharks we tagged in 2016, right? Pretty much in the other years, it was, if they were going to return, it was with a triennial cycle. So only the sharks in 2016 exhibited this wide, very wide variety. Our best explanation is that the 2015-2016 El Nino event affected the coastline sort of unevenly. In some places, the warm water that occurred was really stressful for kelp forests and caused widespread kelp die-offs. And when that happens, remembering that kelp forests is a home for a lot of other fish, including things that soup fins eat, those other fish disappear, they go to other places as well. But in other places, which was quite interesting, kelp forests continue to thrive, right? So it was very, very patchy. So what we think might be happening is, depending on where the soup fin sharks found themselves in the year before tagging and the year of tagging, maybe that affected how much energy they were able to acquire through their food, storing that in their liver, so that when it came time to actually make the oocytes, after they gave, now remember, we tag these sharks when they're pregnant, right? So they give birth, and then they start transferring energy that was previously stored in their liver to make the new eggs. And so you can imagine a situation where if they had like higher than average energy stores that year, again, depending on where they happened to be and where they were feeding, the telogenesis, the process of the eggs, the oocytes growing, that could have been faster. And that could have set up a biennial cycle where they returned 2 years later. But if some sharks happen to find themselves in the patchier areas with the lower quality kelp forest and there's not as much food, maybe their livers didn't have as much energy. And so it took longer for the vitellogenic development of their oocytes during those off years. And so maybe that could have set up a quadrennial return. So again, there's no way to know for sure, but it is curious it only happened to that one cohort. And the only thing that was really obvious about that year and the year before was the El Nino and the warm blob and, you know, the kind of the marine heat wave that persisted off the coast.
So an El Nino event basically causes warmer waters to occur off the coast of our coastline that can change the ecosystem structure and behavior of the animals and the primary production that occurs as well. So the algae that occurs, and that affects the entire ecosystem structure. So theoretically, do you think in a world where, you know, a century ago where there was just more abundant resources off our coastline, do you think soup fins would have been more biennial instead of triennial? Or is that just impossible to even answer?
So although I think that there can certainly be plasticity in the reproductive cycle, I'm imagining that a triennial cycle is kind of just what was selected for. And this took place over way longer than 100 years. And so I suspect that the triennial cycle is kind of, again, the average of what, you know, what these sharks are experiencing, even before humans had anything to do with anything off our coastline. But possibly some weird stuff was happening in 2015, 2016 because of just patchy food distributions. And just as a matter of circumstance, wherever the sharks happened to find themselves, if they were able to acquire more than average energy, maybe that was a biennial cycle that year for that shark. And if they found themselves in a lower quality area with less energy to be stored, maybe it was a quadrennial cycle there. But I have a feeling the triennial cycle is probably not something new.
Got it. And that's so amazing. And the one thing I just really want to emphasize to our listeners is that this is the only species recorded that we have for sure that reproduce on a triennial basis. I read this paper and my mind was absolutely blown. And I see you're anticipating to say something else.
Well, I just wanted to, so it's the only species so far that has documented the triennial migration cycle in Philopatry, but there are a few other species that are known to have the triennial reproductive cycle, the reproducing everything. Like, again, tiger sharks, a few species of wobbegong, a couple of others too. But for sure, the triennial migration, that this is the first so far. There's probably others, but we need to have more of these sort of long-term studies to be able to really capture that pattern.
Sure. And so are other animals, like the males and the juveniles, are they also migrating? Like, do they follow the females?
That's a really good question. At least off the coast of California, we haven't tagged, well, we have started to tag some males, but I don't have any data yet. So we did tag some males in the Northern Channel Islands, but nothing to report yet. So that's a good question. We don't know what their migration cycle is, if anything. But presumably, if they do have some sort of cycle where they go somewhere part of the year and somewhere else, presumably it would be an annual cycle. There's no reason to think that they're only mating, for instance, every 3 years. I'm sure they are mating every year with whatever cohort of mature females happens to be in the same area. So I would imagine, if anything, they would have some sort of annual cycle.
Oh, that's so cool.
So can we briefly touch on, you know, why sharks and other animals migrate during reproduction and just migrate in general for those of our listeners who don't have the same background as the three of us do in migrating?
Yeah. So in general, animals are going to migrate. They're going to move from one place to another, either because they are attracted to some favorable conditions at the destination, and or they are trying to avoid adverse conditions at the starting place, right? So we can think, for instance, you know, many bird species in North America. They're mostly in the spring and summer for breeding purposes. I mean, they're feeding there too, but that's really considered the breeding season when they're up north. And then once winter comes and the food is going to disappear, they migrate south to warmer climates where there's still going to be food for them. So we call those the feeding grounds or the feeding areas. So that's the main reason that they're doing it. It's either because they're attracted to favorable resources where they're going, or they're trying to avoid adverse conditions where they're coming from. Now, in the case of sharks, I wouldn't say that there's much in the way of adverse conditions. I mean, sharks are pretty tough. I mean, the water does get cold, but I mean, certainly sharks have temperature preferences, and water temperature does drive a lot of seasonal movement patterns. But I tend to think that this is more correlated with other stuff that's happening, right? It's not the temperature exactly that's the ultimate reason why they're doing it. So it's probably food availability. In the case of sharks migrating for reproduction, they want to migrate to the female. The pregnant females want to migrate to a place that's good for their pups to grow up, right? So a place where there's maybe shelter, a place where there's good food for them, a place where maybe there's not so many other big predators that could eat them. And then in the other times of the year, maybe it's for food, right? They're trying to just find the best food for them, right? So that they can continue to acquire energy and get ready for the next reproductive cycle. So I think that's, in a nutshell, why animals move on a seasonal basis.
And you mentioned that the pups are found more northward. Do they have a specific habitat? Has that been described yet for the juveniles of soup fins?
No, I mean, so the juveniles are caught occasionally by like surf fishers and pier fishers along the central coast. There's a few interesting documented cases of like some kind of trawl net or something being dragged and catching a whole bunch of them together all at once. Ventura Flats has been, for instance, flagged as one potential area where they could be hanging out. And then certainly there's commercial longline fishers that operate, for example, in the Northern Channel Islands. And I would say they're not catching super tiny soup fins, but they're also using somewhat bigger hooks and bait, but they do catch, you know, larger juveniles. So that suggests that they're probably spending multiple years growing up along the central coastline. But as for like specific habitats, whether it's like sand or rocky reef or kelp forest, I'm not sure we know enough to say.
So was there anything that surprised you during this study that you didn't expect? I know that you mentioned earlier that triennial migration was, you knew that they reproduced every 3 years, but were you surprised that they also migrated every 3 years? Or is there anything else that surprised you from this study?
So although we hypothesized that they were going to leave and come back every 3 years, like in my gut, what I really thought was going to happen was that they would just leave and never come back again. Because we also knew that they were just highly migratory. And I thought, you know, are they going to go so far away only to come back to the same exact spot where we caught them? Probably not, right? There's got to be other places where they can gestate. So it was somewhat surprising that our hypothesis, you know, was supported. I was also surprised by the one shark that came back 3 years and then 6 years. That was amazing. And I was a little surprised at how many sharks were caught in Mexico. So we're talking 15% of the sharks that we caught, that we tagged. That's a big amount. I mean, sometimes like 5 to 10% recapture rate is like, wow, that's it. But 15, that's a lot.
Right.
And this is by like small scale artisanal fishers.
And these are just the ones that
so
were
it's
reported.
Something to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
It's just the one that's that were reported, right?
Yeah, that's so cool.
So I'm shifting us in a new direction that is completely unrelated to what we just finished talking about. I found the concept of skipped spawning to be a really cool concept. And it was mentioned in this paper that soup fins and other sharks, instead of using skipped spawning, they actually have obligate multi-annual reproduction cycles. And so I'm kind of wondering, you know, what the benefits and detriments to something like this would be.
Right. So, so in some bony fishes, right, I mentioned skip spawning in the paper, but I did so to contrast with what we're seeing in cartilaginous fishes, which is not like a facultative, like, oh, we'll skip spawning this year if conditions aren't great. So we'll be biennial this year, we'll be back to annual next year. In the case of, you know, lemon sharks and soup fin sharks and anyone that has a multi-annual reproductive cycle, they can't reproduce annually, at least not that I'm aware of. And one of the main reasons they can't is because their gestation period in many cases is so long. At least in the case of the soup fin shark, the gestation period is 12 months. Now, there are some species that have a very long gestation period and annual reproduction. Leopard sharks are one of those. They have a gestation period of 10 to 11 months, but reproduce every year. But the reason they can get away with that is because they have concurrent vitellogenesis, meaning that while they're pregnant and gestating, the ovary is already producing new oocytes, so that by the time they give birth, there's mature oocytes ready to ovulate with the mother.
What? That's amazing. I didn't know that.
In the case of soup fin sharks, yeah. And so in the case of soup fin sharks, which are in the same family as leopard sharks, it's amazing how different they are, they have consecutive vitellogenesis. So they don't really start developing new oocytes in the ovary until after birth. So there are certain like physiological constraints that basically make it so that the sharks can only give birth, you know, every 2 or 3 years, right? Now, as far as like what benefits, you know, it's just all about trade-offs, right? I mean, it's, I guess you could give birth every year, but maybe you're gonna have smaller individuals that are maybe not, you know, less likely to survive, or you can give birth every 3 years and have a lot more pups at once, maybe giving them a better chance that one of them will survive. So it's kind of hard to say if there's a benefit to it, but it's just the way that evolution has worked out, and it works for each different species, right? To each their own, it works for them.
And did you mention before, I can't recall, do we know how many pups that Sufins tend to pup each time they give birth?
You know, the average escapes me right now, but I personally have seen litter sizes from the low 20s up until like the mid to upper 30s. And I think there's even a few cases of like 40s and low 50s maybe.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of the high end. So again, it's a trade-off, right? It's they're not giving birth every year, but when they do give birth, it's to a lot of pups.
That's really cool. And I mean, for our listeners that might not know, a lot of, especially apex predator sharks, they only produce one or two pups, at most maybe five. So hearing sharks, like superfin sharks, that have way more than that is super interesting. A lot of more benthic or smaller sharks, like leopard sharks, also produce a lot more pups. But it's just so interesting because every shark, like you said, even in the same family of sharks, might have completely different physiology or reproductive habits.
And it's just all about trade-offs, right? Because, I mean, it's a lot of pups, but they're like bite-sized, right? So most of them are probably not going to make it.
Bite-sized.
Yeah, that's fair. Bite-sized.
Really, oh, that true. Made me laugh. Okay, so to close out our episode, we are going to ask you the same question that we ask all of our guest speakers, which is, what is your favorite field story?
So let's see. I mean, fortunately, I feel like we prepare enough and we train enough that we don't really have like crazy bad things happen in the field. So I guess the story that I would tell is more about learning how to do a field ultrasound on a superfin shark. So we knew we had to do this because we had to determine whether these sharks were pregnant, and we didn't want to catch a whole bunch and kill them just to determine that, right? So we knew we had to do an ultrasound. So we actually rented one from a vet, and we practiced on leopard sharks in captivity, right? So we caught some leopard sharks, brought them in tanks, and we figured, they'll be pretty similar. They're in the same family. First of all, that was hard enough. It was hard because I'm not a vet. Like, I've never looked at an ultrasound before. So I'm like, what am I looking for? What is this here? I'm like, is that an egg? Is that a, what is that? We finally figured out with the leopard sharks in captivity, which was like nice and still, controlled. Okay, now fast forward to a boat where we got swell coming in. There's waves. The shark is moving. It was a lot harder. And it took a while to kind of get the hang of it, but it was just so rewarding the first time, like, I actually saw something where I was like, that was an embryo. And then you lose it. And I'm like, oh, gotta find it again. I'm trying to find it again. And then you find it again. You're like, good. Okay, now I gotta get a video. So I'm gonna try to, like, you know, I can't take my eyes off what I'm looking at, because then any slight movement of the transducer and you lose the picture. But it's not so easy to like find the button on the box that I'm wearing to like take a picture. So like by the time I find the box, I've lost the shot. My point is that everything is harder in the field. Nothing ever works. Everything breaks. You lose everything. You forget everything. But sometimes everything works out. And I'm telling you, that moment I saw like the embryo and like, you could see the external gills like flopping, and you see the eye and you see the little mouth. I mean, these are tiny embryos, only a few centimeters long, but you could see them. And it was, I don't know. It was,
I mean, that's, it was just so amazing. Satisfying.
It was, I felt like a little shark doctor. Yeah, it was great.
That's amazing.
So cool.
I mean,
and then when we release them, you know, we could, you know, we know for sure this is a mom, and we're like, good luck with your babies. Like, it totally changes the way you look at it, because they're like, they're pregnant moms, and they, you know.
Oh, that's so amazing. I mean, that's so true. And like, anybody that's been in the field, nothing ever works as it's supposed to. So it's amazing. Can you tell all of our listeners where they can find you, or if they want to read more of your research, where should they follow you to read all about your research?
Well, it was a big deal for me just getting on Twitter. So that's all I got right now. So it's my handle is at Andrew Nosell. So that's probably the best place to find just like fun field photos. And if I publish something, that's where I'll advertise it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again for being here. We absolutely loved reading this paper, and getting to talk to you has been an absolute delight. And we're just amazed by triennial migration. So thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, and good luck with the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right. We will see you, Sharkies, on our next episode. Swim you later.